Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. The great state of Wisconsin is home to the only master cheesemaking program outside of Switzerland. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
This week on Meat & Three, we're telling the stories behind iconic dishes. We learn what it will take to save New York's most famous egg cream, discover the importance of the goat neck in the East Village, and take a trip to India for delicious flatbreads.
Our customers who come in to get egg creams and t-shirts, they love to talk about their childhood or their teenage years or their college years.
I was living in Nepal, in northern India. And out there, there's a real famous dish, a classic dish, I should say, is called paya.
Parathe wali gali, or as it awkwardly translates in English, the lane of the stuffed flatbread makers, is probably one of the most popular food streets in Old Delhi.
Tune in to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, hello, Heritage Radio Network listeners tuning in from 165 countries around the world, about a million listens a month. And today, I'm very confident that every single one of them is tuning into Tech Bites, the weekly show where we look at the intersection of food and technology. I'm Jennifer Leutzi, the host and producer of Tech Bites. And today we have a very special guest. I always say that. I'm always excited by my guests that I have in studio. But my guest today comes from very far away. She comes from Paris, France. So she maybe wins the furthest guest award. Joining us today is Apollonia Poilin, who is visiting New York on the debut of her first book, The Secrets of the World Famous Bread Bakery. If you've ever been to Paris, I'm sure if you're a foodie and you're well-traveled and you read the guidebooks, Poilin is definitely one of the places that you stop at to get something to eat when you go. Their famous bread is like a giant round French sourdough bread that is actually keeps very well. So they ship it around the world and people bring it home in suitcases. Apollonia, thank you for coming, making time in your schedule.
Thank you for your invitation.
I'm very excited about this. And Apollonia and I had a wonderful conversation on the phone last week to sort of workshop the episode. And we think so much of technology as being the future or the next thing, and we often forget that sometimes past technology and past innovations were so great and so monumental that it's hard to improve on them. So through our conversation, we titled this episode Retro Innovation, which is sort of looking back to look forward, I think. But before we do that, before we dig in to the meat of the bread, we will start the show like we always do. I'm curious to hear what her answer is to this question because she's from a different country. Apollonia, what's your favorite app right now?
So my favorite app right now that has been my favorite app for a little while now.
A little while, like 10 years since you got your first phone or?
More like 4 years since okay. I last changed my phone. It's a train app. It gives all the train schedules for European trains. I have a landscape gardener friend who's Swiss, and he gave me the link to this app, and the Swiss have, it's called SBB, and you can download the train schedules, I think of the world, but at least all of Europe, and being Paris-based, going to London where I have a bakery for almost 20 years, and loving to go and escape on weekends or European travels, that app has been like my planner.
So tell us tell us the name of the app again? I'm going to look it up right now and see. And it's kind of amazing that it's the Swiss, known for their timekeeping, who are the ones who have created the ultimate train time schedule app. It's sort of like perfect symmetry there. If only the Swiss could actually run the trains. I came in on the L, and we all know what a non-accurate time schedule that train runs on. So the name of the app?
It's SBB, and I think that's the Swiss-German wording for the train.
SBB Mobile.
Exactly.
Oh, cheap tickets and train information.
So the tickets only work for Switzerland, but the app gives you
There it is.
The French schedule, the UK schedule, the Belgium schedule. I went to the Netherlands recently to go on a cycling trip. Found the schedule, and it's just
So it's called Swiss Travel Guide. Never miss a highlight. Swiss Travel System AG, Switzerland by train, bus, and boat is one. On the SBB CFFFFS website.
And I think that's just the different names of the Swiss train system in French, Italian, and Swiss German.
Amazing. And then there is another app. Correct. So the app, the SBB CFFFFS app, is the timetable app. So they have two options. Fantastic. And they're also free, which we love. Traveling around Europe by train is something that's really wonderful. We don't quite have as much train travel in the U.S. as we used to, which is maybe unfortunate. Anyway, I'm sure you didn't come here by train, though. You came on an airplane. Yes?
Yeah, last time I checked.
So as I said at the top of the show, Apollonia is here. Is this the first stop in your book tour?
It is. I just landed in New York, and I am so looking forward to the next 2 weeks and the opportunity to share bread on various occasions and opportunities.
Well, to get ready for this show, I read through the book, and I also went back and listened to an episode that I did back in October of 2017 with Nathan Myhrvold on his Modernist Bread book. And the total bread immersion over the past few days has really made me hungry for bread, which I've tried to sidetrack myself knowing that we would be at Roberta's and have pizza, which is bread derivative. But it really made me hungry thinking about it. You are the third generation at the, would you call it a boulangerie? I know that in the English title it says bread bakery, but is that boulangerie?
It's a boulangerie, for sure.
Okay. Third generation, your grandfather Pierre opened it in 1932. And my first question is, if he opened his own boulangerie in 1932, he must have been baking prior to that. Was he generationally the son of a boulanger also? Because many of these things, typically, especially in France, tend to be familial and multi-generation.
Yeah, so my grandfather started the baking tradition for our family, but we were not that far away because we were farmers. So we went from field to baking, basically, around the time of my grandfather. So you're absolutely right. When my grandfather started the bakery on 8 Rue du Cherche Midi, he had been traveling around France, and more specifically the south of France, working in various bakeries, and then eventually opening his own bakery in the heart of Paris. Now, Saint-Germain-des-Prés at that time was an up-and-coming area filled with artists and craftsmen, and his thing was...
writers. That's the sort of whole lost generation for Americans, the Hemingways.
Yeah.
Fitzgeralds, all the artists who were in that neighborhood at that time.
Absolutely. And you know, look, I'm 35 today, but I remember as a kid seeing just the last workshops, lighting stores. There still are a few artisans and craftsmen. There's certainly many artist studios still, but it really is an area in the center of Paris that is very unique, and we take a lot of pride in being from Saint-Germain-des-Prés.
The shop on Cherche Midi, is that the original shop then? It's, if you've never visited, I recommend anybody who's going to be in Paris to go by the shop. It's surprisingly tiny.
It's French.
And it's you know, the Heritage Radio Network studios are two repurposed shipping containers, you know, like giant steel boat shipping containers, and they are put together in the shape of an L, and one side is the what we call the green room, and I'm using very large asterisks around that, the engineering booth, and then the studio. And I would say that, you know, when you walk into the shop, it's maybe like the size of this. It's
tiny, absolutely.
And you have the little counter and then the bread behind it. I'm assuming there's something underneath and above.
Well, exactly. So Ritri du Cherche Midi is this like tiny store, and you come into this brick clad facade, and you have the bread on your left and our biscuits and other products, dry products to the right. You have a counter where you will be able to pay for your order. And then if you peek into the back, you'll see the little back room, which serves as an office, serves as our breakfast room and our prep room. And yes, in the basement, we have the oven, our wood-fired brick oven, which allows us to bake throughout the day and fit as best as we can the production's needs.
So when
or the sales needs, rather.
When that shop was opened back in 1932, is that the original oven from that period in time?
Yep.
And at that period in time, was that the best of modern technology? Was that the newest, latest, greatest oven for bread baking? Or was it just a new version of an old model?
Yeah. So yes and no. Electrical ovens, as they've been making their way, have slowly replaced the types of ovens that we've had. I'm not sure how old our wood-fired oven is, but it's the kind of beasts that you build and that you maintain after that. So when people ask me how old the oven is, I like to joke, picking the latest update or work we've done on it. So last month in September, one of the aspects of the door to the oven was broken. So I literally said this last week. I said, "Well, you know, this oven is a month old," which clearly people can tell is not the case. But back in its day, ovens like those were just coming out of fashion. And the reason why my grandfather liked them so much is because it provides a really dry heat. And it makes for a bread that will have a thicker crust, a little bit less moist, which I think helps it keep longer. But I think also just creates a dough texture that's less wet, literally.
On the outside, but on the inside, the bread is very moist. So it almost seems counterintuitive.
So it's very moist, but it's not. It doesn't have the wetness that some breads have. So it's like our you know, I was trying to find a visual cue to describe my loaves. So in the book, I described them as these big hugs of bread, because, well, I was catering clearly to an American audience, but in my family, we love to hug people. And so I thought that was the volume, that it represented the shape and volume of our bread. And so our breads are thick crusts and have a dense crumb that makes for great sandwiches or a tartine, an open-faced sandwich.
As just a side note, before we get back to the technology for making the bread back in 1932, I was fascinated by the bread sandwich recipe in the book, which is exactly as it sounds. It is two slices of toasted buttered bread with a slice of fresh, non-toasted, non-buttered bread in the middle, which sounds just crazy to me. But then when I was reading the description of it, I also really wanted one.
So this recipe actually stems from a wink that my father liked to make about saying, you know, when bread is really good, you could really use it as something to sustain you. And bear in mind that in the early 20th century in France, an average French person would eat almost 900 grams of bread.
How many baguettes is that? A baguette is, by law, 250 grams? Something like that?
There's various forms, but that would be roughly, that would be around four of the longer breads. That would be about half of my loaf of bread. So yeah, it's like a lot of bread. But it speaks as to the place, and bear in mind that people wouldn't have eaten four baguettes. It would have been more of the country style breads back in the day. But so you would have that amount of bread that was really meant to sustain you. And that's, I think, accounted for the success of my grandfather in the 30s, because the artists and craftsmen needed bread that kept and bread that would sustain their workday. So the sandwich, while clearly intended as a wink, it's also something, you know, there is actually food for thought in there. If you have bread that will sustain you, using it as a filler will actually make sense.
And the bread itself, made from the flour, water, starter, salt.
Flour, water, salt, and sourdough. So a piece of dough from one batch, which we use as a starter for the following batch, adding water, flour, and salt to it.
So back in 1932, the way the loaves were made and baked, how different is that from the way the loaves are made and baked today?
Well, not that different, because... And in preparation of our meeting today, the two of us discussed how, in the greater history of bread baking, the past 100 years have, you know, really are
drop
nothing.
Drop in the bucket.
Yeah, and so I say this because we've been experimenting with electrical ovens, yeasts, in you know, like, as a profession, but these are relatively new inventions, right? And my grandfather started his wheat sourdough recipe and probably perfected it enough that when my father apprenticed on Ritre du Cherche Midi, and when I apprenticed later on, that recipe was pretty stable. So, and we love to test and try different things, and understanding that we more likely than not will not revolutionize the recipe, but better understand why it is made that way.
One of the reasons why I went back to listen to the Nathan Myhrvold episode, which, if people want to go back and listen to it as well, it's episode 114. His book, Modernist Bread, is actually five volumes. It's 2,500 pages. I think there's something like 1,500 recipes in it. And part of the conversation that we have about his interest in the history of bread is the history of bread is very much the history of humankind and civilization. And initially, you know, archaeologists and historians had put bread's arrival, you know, on the dinner table at somewhere around, you know, 25,000 years ago, until very recently, Canadian archaeologist discovered in some caves of Mozambique some grinding bowls that had sorghum flour in them. And when you have grinding bowls or stones and flour, then that means they were making some sort of bread-like object. Otherwise, you wouldn't be grinding grains to flour. And those caves and artifacts date to 100,000 years ago, which now puts bread in a very, very old place in time. And then, you know, when you think about it, the grinding stones that they use today to mill flour probably have not changed all that much.
They haven't.
But it really is an interesting, if you follow the history of bread, you really do have a history of sort of the different innovations of civilization, grinding, fire, agriculture to grow the grains.
Bringing people together. And mm-hmm. That's, I think, I mean, one of the reasons, I love Nathan's book because I think that if anyone, only him could really go at having a very passionate but not involved in the craft on a daily basis.
And
scientific, exactly.
He he delights in it, but he has a very scientific mind. So he goes it in a very
dry
research,
way, but
academic kind of way.
Exactly. I'm failing to find the right words, but I think your auditors can probably imagine what we're saying. And so, yeah, like for me, one of the reasons why I like my craft so much is because it interconnects people. And people from various horizons. But as you said, like, if you orchestrate, I mean, bearing in mind that bread has been, in one shape or form or another, has fed us for generations and generations.
100,000 years.
It's such a great human connector.
Has there been any technology that you have changed? Have you installed anything new or newfangled? Any, I don't know, digital scales or packaging you now ship to 40 countries around the world? Do you use, is all your technology just in the packaging and distribution perhaps now?
Yeah, so all of the above. And one that I, when my father redid, he like updated the bakery and its the shop and stuff, he installed an elevator for the bread. And I remember him telling me very proudly in the mid-90s, I'm so happy that I'm going to be able to use an elevator now to bring up the bread, because as an apprentice, I had to bring it up every day. And so it's going to make such a drastic change for the team. But yes, there's also beyond the bread baking process, there's also the packaging. How do we find an organization that helps us simplify the packaging so that we can focus on the quality of what we do?
What do you have to do to bread to package it to be able to ship it around the world but maintain that its form? Delivery, food delivery is a very popular topic right now in the social world, in the food tech world, you know, all the delivery services now. One of the big challenges for restaurants is how do you put, you know, food that's meant to be served in a dining room immediately going from the kitchen to the table. How do you put that into a container and have it sit for a half hour, 45 minutes before it gets to the person?
Well, in this case, the bread would be really the center of attention. And our loaves, you know, were never meant to be eaten in the bakery itself. So they were always thought through to take home. So that puts then the focus on the packaging. And I would say to that effect that one of my favorite things when I work in the bakehouse is take my loaf of bread to bring back home, and especially in the winter, and just put it against my stomach and zip it up under my jacket to keep me warm. But the packaging would be important.
Before you put it, zip it into your jacket, do you wrap it in paper? Does it
I
go
do.
Into the canvas bag? What's the optimum transportation
vessel? There are different things, but we've been using different types of paper allow for enough breathability. But and when we ship the bread, we double wrap it. We also like our bread to be thoroughly cooked so that it can create also within the product a seal, because in bread, as it ages, it can go either two ways. It can mold because it's too humid, or it becomes stale because it's too dry. But the larger the volume, the more time it takes for air to get to the crumb and dry it out. So having a thick crust, having a thoroughly cooked bread will help that.
And the wood-fired stove is the best way to do that?
For our recipe, yes.
Have you tried the electric stoves?
We've tried it for our loaves, and it doesn't work as well because our recipe was perfected for this kind of oven.
Interesting.
And you were talking about electronic scales.
Mm-hmm.
So we use a Roman scale, and it's not so much that we're weighing the pieces.
Describe
of bread.
What a Roman scale is, because my
yes.
guess is not
yes.
many of our listeners have them on their kitchen counters. We have an electric scale on our kitchen counter. Sometimes
yeah.
we have two, but I don't think we have a Roman scale.
So what I call a Roman scale is really a low-tech two plates that are held with held by three little chains and set apart by a metal rod.
So an actual balance.
An actual
with the
balance.
Weights.
With
so
the
you,
weights.
You put one item on one side and the weights on the other, and then when they balance out, that's how you know how much
exactly.
it weighs.
Exactly. But we sell the bread by weight, so we're not trying to aim for the gram, unless we're on the small hand rolls. In that case, we do have an electronic scale. But when we're cutting out the volume of the bread loaf out of the bread box, the baker effectively weighs it by eye and by habit. The scale, or the balance, really serves to control that. And we recently did a test where we used an electronic scale to see the impact of that, if we managed to be more precise. And what we found was that we were so focused by the number that we doubled the scaling time and effectively ruined the fermentation. So it didn't work. And what we learned from that was that it really, we think that it really is about the wording. So when we're saying we're scaling the loaf, it's not about the weight. We're actually just controlling with the balance that the bread loaf is the right weight.
Interesting. Took more time to use technology. Well, we are going to take a little bit of time right now to find out who the sponsor is of this show. Did you know that Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit? That means we're kind of like public radio, and we keep the lights on and the mics hot out of the generosity of our members, who are mostly listeners like you, grants, and underwriters like this one. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that 90% of Wisconsin's milk is made into cheese? And this is not just any milk. When Swiss, German, and Italian cheesemakers first settled into Wisconsin, they chose their new home because of the special terroir of the region. Its soil and water are nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin produces 25% of all cheeses made in the U.S., and Wisconsin cheeses have won more awards than any other state or country in the world. How do they do it? Wisconsin cheesemakers combine their heritage and tradition with nonstop innovation. They were the first state to establish cheese grade standards and the first to require that every cheese plant be overseen by a licensed cheesemaker. Wisconsin is the only place outside of Europe where one can pursue an elite master cheesemaker certification. All of these impeccably high standards mean Wisconsin produces more than 48% of the nation's specialty cheese.
Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe. Taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Tickets available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
Well, if you're just joining us and you're wondering what the hell you clicked on, this is Tech Bites, the weekly show on the Heritage Radio Network, where we talk to innovators and influencers in the food tech space. Do you have an idea for a show? Are you an innovator or a founder of an amazing new piece of food technology? Reach out and get in touch with us. We are very interactive. You can find us online and social media at TechBitesHRN. You can email us, techbites@heritageradionetwork.org. We'd love to hear from you. You never know. We've had lots of listeners on the show and great suggestions from people around the world. If you would like to meet me or any of the other Heritage Radio Network hosts, engineers, staff, we are having a gala on Monday, November 11th. It is to celebrate our 10th anniversary. That is an entire decade of food radio. thousands and thousands and thousands of episodes in the archives. We are going to hold the gala at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. It's a beautiful space at night and in the fall. You can find tickets at heritageradionetwork.org/gala. And if you use the code TECHBITES, you will get a discount. I will be there. Most of the other hosts will be there. We have DJ Cherish the Love, who will be playing. We have silent auction, lots of food and drink, and it will be a really wonderful event. So I hope you will all join us, and I will get to meet some of my listeners in person. But today, who I have in person in the studio with us is Apollonia Poilin. She's third generation of the amazing bakery in Paris, Poilin, which I'm sure many of you have been to. She is here on the occasion of publishing her first cookbook. And is it the first Poilin book also?
It's not the first Poilin book, but it's the first English language one.
Okay. And I'm sure that's mostly what people, I'm sure that's mostly what most of the listeners really care about. If you want to find out more about Poilin, go to poilin.com. That's P-O-I-L-A-N-E. You can find them on social media at Pain Poilin. That's P-A-I-N-P-O-I-L-A-N-E. If you want to follow Apollonia, she is at Apollonia_Poilin. So the bakery in Paris, Boulangerie, was opened in 1932, and it sounds like you haven't really changed that much of the process for making the bread since then. Have you mixers? Have you gone to modern mixers? Do you use the proofing cabinets? Do you use...
So we
anything that's different from 1932?
I mean, we definitely have a new mixer. We don't have a 1932 mixer, but we don't use the proofing cabinets. We really enjoy to see how our loaves naturally interact with the environment, and that's just because it's something that, you know, that's alive and that we want to be able to foster.
The environment gives something back to
exactly.
the bread.
But when I'm saying to you not much has changed, what you don't see is, or what you see is the tip of the iceberg of all of the works that we've done to make sure that we shouldn't change those things. And that conversation between past techniques and contemporary techniques is what my father called retro-innovation. So using the best of past techniques and questioning them at present with contemporary techniques to feed, to nurture the future.
I think one of the interesting things you said in the first half of the show is that the Poilin bread was perfected in the environment of the shop on Cherche Midi. So that oven, that environment to rise, I'm sure, you know, the flours that you had at that point in time. So something that's been perfected for a very specific set of circumstances, if you want to maintain that product, it raises a good question. How much can you change the circumstance around it and still arrive at the same product? I'd be curious to know, over the years, how have the ingredients changed?
I mean they change every season. The flour we use, and we've been working with our flour millers, and for most of them, they're farmers and growers for generations now. So every year, as we work on the blend of flour, and I use the word blend in reference to the coffee culture.
Or champagne or wine.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. we work on that blend with them, and that's what creates a similarity, and yet accounting for different years, different crops, different weather conditions, and that continuity and that conversation and our choices is what has fostered our tradition.
I don't know that people really think that much about the necessity of having everything sort of be exactly the same to produce something that's exactly the same over time. It's one of the challenges of being a great restaurant. You know, to be a truly great restaurant and get a great review, not only do you have to make an amazing meal, but you have to make that amazing meal exactly that amazing for every single diner, every single day, at every single service. And baking, you know, one iconic, very well-known loaf of bread for, you know, 90 years now?
88 years next 88 year.
88 years?
88 years in 2020.
That's a long time to think about that, you know, consistency of, you know, flour and water and salt and things like that just over time. There have to be slight variations.
Yeah, and consistency doesn't mean it's exactly the same. And as you say, there are slight variations. And even from, you know, one batch to the next, and that's the beauty of our craft, is that, and that's why in the training program we have internally, what we train our bakers to do for 9 months is essentially attuning their five senses to adapting to the weather's conditions, the seasonal conditions. And those are all things that contribute to a consistency, but consistency doesn't mean it's exactly the same. And in fact, the fact that we are able to keep that consistency, but at the same time allow it to evolve it. I mean, I can give you the example of how we've changed a couple of months, almost a few years now, our logo, and it was both greeted with a lot of positive reactions, but a lot of people didn't notice. And that was such, I mean, you know, that was very, that, those were two really positive feedbacks we got, because we were thinking like, for me, consistency doesn't mean we're static. To feed consistency or to feed a balance, you need to fuel it. You need to nurture it so that it stays in that balance.
Sounds like the most important piece of technology in your shop are the actual bakers who are really, you know, honing their craft and, you know, using their observation and their skills to create, you know, the bread day to day. People are very difficult to reproduce and replicate, though. How has it been maintaining a staff of artisan bakers? Have you seen a uptick, a downdrop in people interested in learning this profession? How do you see it going forward in terms of having the people to train to be better than the scale?
Yeah, well, apprenticeship is part of the answer, surely. The sharing of a love and passion for a craft from one generation of bakers to the next. And then each generation has their own skill set, their own specificities. We have bakers that are amazing at doing bread decorations. We have bakers that are fantastic about teaching. And I think it's about that, the diversity of skill sets, and that allows us, and also the fact that we have been a family business since 1932 that's developed its retailers network. So we do have a team that work together for that.
Do you have a lot of applications for people who want to come and be apprentice bakers at Polo?
We definitely do have applications, and it's,
staff is something that people in the food and restaurant world in this country find very challenging, especially in urban areas.
And it's challenging everywhere. But my colleagues, and I call my colleagues in baking compagnons, because we share a craft and a know-how. And, you know, there's the etymology of the words, that's someone with whom you share bread. But beyond that, we also share a tradition.
So for a person who's going to pick up the book and maybe do some baking at home, what type of equipment and, you know, technology do they need at their house?
Not much.
A bowl,
maybe a fork, and your hands. Boy, your hands are the most sophisticated and most beautiful tool you can imagine. And my parents, in choosing the word manufacture, back in the early 80s, when they created, my mom as an architect and my father as a baker, a place where we could produce bread for our retailers network. So there's 24 ovens, one next to the other, and it really operates like four independent bakeries, like just in one spot. They chose the word manufacture to reflect the fact that our hands are the most important tool in baking. So if you pick up this book to bake breads, just wash your hands and get baking.
What do you bake the bread in?
There's many methods. I started using a crock pot.
That sounds slightly blasphemous. a crock pot, like an actual plug-in crock pot?
No, sorry, I'm probably using the bad word. Like a Le Creuset.
Like a Dutch oven.
A Dutch oven.
A
marmite, that's what the word we would use.
So like a cast iron with a lid or a Dutch oven with a lid.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I literally went into the cupboard, working on the recipe for the book. I was discussing and having different friends test the recipes. And one friend suggested something that I know has been popular in the U.S. And so I pulled out my parents' pot from Le Creuset and just like, put my loaf in, and it helped tremendously. Mm-hmm. It's super hard to bake bread at home, and the reality is that as a baker, I have my bakehouse, so I enjoy nothing more than working in the bakehouse to make my loaf of bread. But when at home, that was my choice.
So you need your hands to make the dough. What do you put the dough in to let it rise?
So you can use one of our wicker baskets that are covered in linen, mm-hmm. and in testing, just use a colander and a loose weave linen.
Like kitchen towel. Torchon or something like that.
Absolutely.
That's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
So a colander, because it has air, it's perforated, and then you line the colander with a kitchen towel or some sort of linen napkin or something, and then you let it rise in there.
Exactly.
That's a very clever hack if you don't have the...
The wicker basket.
Canvas-lined wicker basket.
Yeah. The wooden one, for that matter. That was...
It's a very good idea. And then you put it into the Dutch oven or the Le Creuset, and then you bake it, and then voila.
Yep.
Sounds easy enough. And then you need to make two kinds of bread if you want that bread sandwich.
You should. So my father did that bread sandwich recipe with the intent of using just our wheat sourdough bread. But taking his idea a little bit beyond that, I thought, well, my rye and raisin bread, the rye flour has a distinctive flavor, different taste. So why not use that? And for that matter, if you use the rye and raisin or currant slice of that bread, or my wheat bread with walnuts inside, then you have an entirely different thing. So, you know, if you're going to cook with this book, not bread, but what I call bread cooking, which is using bread as an ingredient, just go full force on exploration. Like, that's the best thing you can do with this book. And by all means, grab a bunch of sticky notes and just, like, write down all of your different options and the different tests and trials and make that book your own through that way.
Well, it's a lovely book. I encourage people who are interested in bread and also just interested, I think, in really nice French cooking. There's some great recipes like a croque monsieur and things like that in it, which are, you know, of course, a taste of France. I do not recommend that you read the book or look at any of this online if you're hungry. It's been very torturous doing all this research, and we're gonna end the show right now so we can go have pizza and maybe some of the hot bread from the pizza oven with the stracciatella. But before we go, I want to make sure everybody has all the information. It is Secrets of the World Famous Bread Bakery, Poilin by Apollonia Poilin. Find it online, poilin.com. You can find them on social media, at Pam Poilin. You can follow Apollonia at Apollonia Poilin. If you want to hear Nathan Mirville talk about the history of bread, he's a fascinating interview and a lot of fun. That's episode 114 of Tech Bites. I also have a couple of interesting episodes. If you're fascinated by the idea of retro innovation or ancient technology or old tech for modern cooking, I have a couple of interesting episodes. 131, which is tech-enabled culinary history, which is a goodie. And also episode 132, which is ancient food tech. It's not alien, but it's still old. Apollonia, thank you for joining us all the way from Paris. We're happy to be one of your first stops on your book tour. Do you have any bread shops or restaurants or things on your list in New York or in the country?
Well, all of this week, my bread will be at Lafayette.
Oh, very nice.
I'm super excited about that.
So that's Lafayette. That's the Andrew Carmelini restaurant on Lafayette in downtown Manhattan.
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful, big, sort of classic French-style brasserie-type affair.
And thank you for greeting me and giving me the opportunity to share my love and passion. Thank you.
My pleasure. If you like this episode, come back and visit with us on Tuesday evenings at 6:15 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you love it and want to take it with you, we are on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, all the good podcasting platforms. If you really, really love us, you know, come to the gala, go to heritageradionetwork.org, give us a little bit of a donation, help us stay on the air for another 10 years. I want to thank Jeet, who was our engineer today, DJ Uptown Nico for our amazing little techno song called Nomad CPU Track, which is our theme. I'm Jennifer Liuzzi, and this is Tech Bytes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.